Welcome to the podcast of MotorWeek, television's original automotive magazine. MotorWeek is made possible by RockAuto.com. Here's your host, John Davis.
Thank you, Alec Webb, our announcer for MotorWeek, as well as our podcast. I am John Davis. Welcome to MotorWeek podcast number 62. And we're all sitting around the studio and in Studio C, kind of marveling that we have done 62. Anyway, with us today is our road test producer and two-wheeling reporter, Brian Robinson.
Hello, John.
Our associate producer, Ben Davis.
Hello.
And our writer, Brandon Holthouse.
Hey, that's me.
And one more special. We have a special guest today, Jonathan Lowe, who's with us visiting from Detroit Public Television. Jonathan, thank you very much for being such a great supporter of Detroit Public TV. And welcome to our MotorWeek podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Terrific. Okay, we've got a lightning round as usual. Also, we'll look at our mailbag. But first, we're going to take a look at a few of the vehicles we've been testing lately on the show and coming up on near-term episodes of MotorWeek. We're going to start with a car that I think certainly surprised me. It's the Chevrolet Sonic, a new subcompact from Chevrolet designed in Korea, but built in the U.S., and the first subcompact to be built in the U.S., I think, since MotorWeek's been on the air, if not much longer than that. Wow. Brandon, you had a chance to go to the press preview. We've all had a chance to drive it. But let me start with you. Give me your impressions of the Sonic.
Sure. Yeah, I got to go on the test preview in San Francisco, and that was a lot of fun.
Even in those hills.
I got to tell you, the Chevy Sonic, that's one of the greatest things about the car is that it has a hill holder on it. That's why they took us to San Francisco to test that out, and it worked really well. It's a great, great city car. A lot of the design, especially on the interior, is perfect for somebody that's in a city. It's got, you know, two glove boxes for an MP3 player and an iPod. It's got two storage compartments right next to the radio, so you can store a cell phone or if you don't like to sit on your wallet while you're driving. I know I don't like doing that. And it's even got a place to put your garage ticket right underneath the stereo. So it's got a little slot, holds the garage ticket right in there. It's perfect for somebody in a city.
What do you think about the styling, guys? I mean, it's definitely more stylish than a lot of the small cars.
I like the styling. I thought it was really cool looking compared to what's out there. I mean, this is a really intense segment right now. A lot of subcoms coming.
Sure.
Fiesta,
the Accent,
Rio, yeah. That Toyota IQ, Scion IQ coming out. So, and they're all pretty nice. So it's going to be tough for the Sonic to stand out.
What do you think about that motorcycle influence that they talk so much about and the headlights and on the instrument panel?
Yeah. You're the two-wheeling guy.
Well, yeah. I could definitely see it. I mean, that motorcycle inspired has been thrown out in like almost every car in the last 15 years, but you could definitely tell in the gauge package it had a round tachometer with the smaller digital readout for the speedo and stuff like that. So in that way, I thought it was pretty cool.
Hey, Ben?
Now, I noticed, I don't know if it's just me or not, but the clutch seemed to let up really high on the travel.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a little, with the turbo motor, it was a little difficult for me to drive. I drive like an old man.
Hmm.
And I don't know if it's just me, but
I don't believe that for a second.
Is that with your turn signal on for an extended period of time?
Let's not get too bad.
Would you put your arm out the window for turns? Go ahead.
Anyway, it seemed to me that the engine was most happier when you were on it a little bit, giving it some gas. And for my driving style, it didn't seem like the turbo was spooling up that much at all. It was kind of almost difficult for me to drive slow. Does that make
makes sense? Yeah, no, I think it does. There's two engines we should point out. There's the standard 1.8, and then there's the 1.4 turbo, both used in the larger cruise. But I think you're right. The 1.4 turbo, you need to be on it a bit.
Yeah.
I liked the car much more than I expected. I found it, compared to the other subcompacts we've had recently, very quiet. As a matter of fact, that was actually my biggest complaint about the Accent. Is a great looking little car, and actually I think it's got a roomier back seat than the Sonic, but it was loud.
Definitely loud.
And this Sonic seemed to have thicker glass. It's got better sound insulation, so I felt like I was in a more expensive car. Anyway, you cut it for an American made small car, it was pretty good.
Yeah, definitely was. Especially when you're talking about the sound. Yeah. In San Francisco, we were at a stoplight. Right next to me was this really big diesel truck.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy I was driving with just said, turn your windows down. And put the windows down. And, I mean, it was like right in your face. Put the windows up, you could barely hear that other engine.
Huge improvement over what it replaced.
Aveo. Yeah.
The Aveo, even though the...
I missed that one.
You know, it's interesting. The Aveo actually began this new move back towards modern subcompacts, but it got quickly eclipsed, and it was a little bit – it was kind of bulbous and really was not a very impressive car at all. And I think the Sonic's a huge step forward.
Definitely.
I hope they do well with it. Okay, let's move on to a car that I think will not find too many detractors around the table. Now, wait, before I do that, Jonathan, any impression on small cars? I know you're not a small car guy. But you've obviously in Detroit, you've probably seen the Sonic running around.
I think it's a nice looking car. I've never been in it. Clearly, I think there's a market
for it. Did you notice it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have smart cars.
Right.
The sort of roller skates with two doors. So you can't help but notice them.
So what was your first impression? Because you drive a BMW.
I do.
So you drive a German car.
I do.
And you told me at lunch you don't have that great high of regard for some of the U.S. cars in the past.
Well, I think they're getting much better. And we were talking about the Buick LaCrosse, which I think is a terrific car, and really in all respects. I'm delighted that Chevy has come up with a good small car. We need it.
I mean, sure
not everybody can drive a big car and can afford a big car. And I think this is something that's very important to have, an affordable kind of entry-level car.
That's gotten good reviews, and I think also the fact that it's actually built in the U.S. I think is pretty significant.
And quiet is the key.
Yeah, it is.
Because some of these cars are so loud that you come out of them, you can't even hear.
So, all right, let me start with you. You're a BMW owner.
Just recently.
Just recently, but all right. As a BMW owner, what do you think of Audis before we get into the A6, which is our next? Do you have any opinions of them?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
I have never driven an Audi. I've driven in an Audi. I've never driven one. I think they're really getting to be really beautiful. I mean, the styling, the LED lights.
That's a very good point.
Are beautiful. We were talking earlier about the R80, what's the
The A8, and then the R8 sports car.
R8 sports coupe, which I think may be one of the most beautiful cars on the road today.
That's a good segue. Ben, give us a more of a background on the A6. This new A6 is a very pretty car.
That's for sure. No doubt about it.
You know, let me jump start you there, Ben.
I don't know why you came on me on that one. Put me on the spot.
It's almost a little bit like it almost looks like they took the A8, which I think we all agree is an incredible sedan, and just shrunk it up a little bit.
Well, Jonathan kind of took all my everything I was going to say about it, but it's certainly gorgeous.
Not too many cars leave us speechless.
It's a
true knocking.
It's another hit. I mean, the A8 is awesome. The A7 is amazing. I mean, now they just one after another just keeps coming out with them. The big thing with the A6, much like the A8 recently. They're moving in a bit of a more sporty direction with the ride and handling, especially the sport package, which is really stiffens up the ride a lot, like a true sport package should. So that was really the main difference with this A6. There, it's going in a much sporty direction.
I guess we start talking about up level German cars, and it's easy to get put off by the price tags. But when you look at an A6 for $50,000-ish. It's very competitive against other cars. The powertrain, it's tough to knock it. The 3-liter 6 is a terrific motor.
Supercharged.
Yeah, supercharged engine. You know, it's all-wheel drive. The Quattro system works very, very well, and just about even in dry. The interior, those are such knockouts.
Yeah,
I honestly don't think anyone does a more beautiful interior.
I agree 100%.
Also, not just beautiful, easy to use, even with all the high-tech features. Everything's very intuitive, and you don't have to go through 100 menus to change stuff.
Definitely.
Go ahead, Brandon.
I love the fact, it's a pretty common thing now, but the screen that appears from nowhere, that's just one of the features I love in a car.
But, when you look at their interface system and compare it to BMW's iDrive and Mercedes, it's the easiest to use. Mm-hmm. It's the easiest to override, which is very important. I just think they've done a great job. The only thing that ever worries me about Audis is what you hear from customers about their long-term maintenance. That they tend to be, it seems to be, the people's impressions are they're more expensive than a Mercedes or a BMW to maintain. If they can overcome that issue, I'm not sure there's anything stopping them. They're terrific cars.
True. And Audi owners, they seem to be in the car 3 years and out into a new one. So
Yeah, they lease at the very high lease rate, so I guess they don't really seem to care about that.
Yeah.
Well, let's now move on to another German brand, and really the one I expect that no one's going to be lost for words on, BMW, and specifically the 1 Series M Coupe, setting the stage. M, we all know, is M for motorsport. It's what BMW calls all of their in-house tuner cars. They do it to just about everything they make. But in the past, they've always been extraordinarily pricey, but that seemed to match their performance. Here is an interesting effort. The 1M Series Coupe is still expensive, but it's not as expensive, and it doesn't have quite as much power pumped up in the engine department as some of the other M's. But does that make it less than an M? Let me start with everybody. Who would like to be first?
I put that thing right up there against a 911 or a Corvette as far as fun to drive and just overall.
To you, it's and to you, it's every bit of it. It's a sports car. It's
absolutely
not going to call it a sport coupe. It's a sports car.
Yeah.
So what? You know, expand on that.
It's just amazing how. I mean, I usually think 911 Corvette. That's the end all be all of that kind of vehicle. But with the 1M, you have all the fun to drive of these vehicles. Plus, you got a little bit of a trunk. And
a little bit of a back
seat. Quasi back seat. It's an amazing car.
They did a nice job, I think, on besides all the hardware to make it go and handle better, which I know Brian wants to talk about. They toughened it up a little bit.
Yeah, it's all the whole suspension is all pretty much right off the M3, which, you know, again, no one's going to complain about the way an M3 handles. And to me, it's just the perfect. This one series needed this. And I think BMW needed it. I mean, it's the perfect marriage of their, you know, their M brand and the 1 Series is the perfect car for it. It's just, it's a sports car first and a daily driver second. It's super tight in there. Everything fits
like a sports car should.
Yeah. And, you know, we were just talking about motorcycle inspired. It's not motorcycle inspired, but it's the closest driving experience you can have to a motorcycle of any car out there I can think of. I mean, you're nailed down to the road. And that chassis is, with all the M3 bits, it's just amazing. You can handle another 100 horsepower and not be too much for it.
Yeah, that was actually the only thing. Now, you do have the turbo boost, which boosts your turbo pound feet, your torque, your pulling power up to about, 370 for launches. But, you know, if you're doing a slow launch, I was a little disappointed. I thought it is a car that means you need to get into it, need to get into the throttle.
It's not that much faster in a straight line, but it handles way better than the 135.
And you actually did the original draft of the text of the test, and you wrote down that it was the perfect canvas. Explain what you meant
by
that.
Sure, that's just what I was saying. The M3 is just, with each generation, it gets bigger and bigger and more bloated. Not that it's not, it's still a great car, but to get down to that original, just sports car first, daily driver second, this is the perfect car for that.
Brandon, you've been quiet. You want to weigh in?
I agree with what everybody's saying. I mean, it's a ball to drive. It's definitely a sports car. Little thing just for me is that the seats were a little bit, hard and they were stiff. But, I mean, it's a sports car. It's got to be like that.
$10,000 cheaper than the M3. We should put that in there.
Yeah, I think we should, because I think that does make a difference between – because someone's going to probably buy this as a second car.
How would they do it against Lotus and stuff like that on local racetracks and autocross strips and stuff like that? I imagine they're decimating.
They've got to be right there, yeah. I haven't heard anything.
And it's when you compare it to something like a Lotus, while I love Lotuses, I mean, it's a heck of a lot more car.
Yeah.
I mean, just all the way around, feature-wise.
More everyday.
Structure, everything.
Friendly.
Yeah.
At the time it came out, they said it would just be a 1 year, 2011, year and done. Not sure if that's changed or not.
Well, they've got a new 1 Series coming, and we haven't seen the new coupe yet, but it's hard to believe that they won't turn around and redo it again.
Well, it took them long enough to do this to the 1 Series now, so who knows what they're going to do. BMW owner, what do you think?
Yeah,
weigh in, please.
I know you don't own an M car of any variety, but, as a BMW owner, you must have an opinion. Do you think that the M brand, as it were, makes sense? Any comments?
I'm sure it does to a certain auto enthusiast.
Now you're going to tell me you're too practical.
I don't see the need for it. My 535 has plenty of power, and it has a turbo. Mm-hmm. And if I want it to go fast, it goes very fast for a big car. So I don't know how much faster you need a car to go.
Number one rule of automotive journalism, there's never enough power.
Okay.
Even though that may fly in the face of a lot of the full fuel economy thing. But that's another thing, actually. BMW is managed to blend so much of its new performance with really some very impressive fuel economy.
I think that's the transmission that does that.
At that, least and
unbelievably seamless
looking at
transmission.
All their, you were commenting about that. Go ahead and give us that comment. We were driving a rival brand at lunch, and you made some comments about just how different your BMW, which is an automatic, felt. So
right.
Give me an idea.
It's actually one of my favorite parts of the car. As you accelerate, you can feel the car going through the gears, but almost seamless.
Mm-hmm.
Very quiet, very almost imperceptible, and it's just a pleasure. And the other thing that my car has is this hill holder option or benefit.
Well, it's the downhill grade. I forgot what they call it. Land Rover developed it, where you could go down a grade and take your feet off the accelerator and the brake, and it basically walks you down the hill. Yeah.
But as I'm driving, even approaching a stoplight, if I take my foot off the gas, it will slow down to the point where I almost don't have to put on the brake, which is really quite
amazing. But you don't take your hands off the wheels.
I don't
just
take
your hands
off
the wheels.
Never.
Okay, very good.
It was just to dial the phone or send a quick text.
Please don't do that either.
Don't do that either.
Okay, let's move on now to our lightning round. Now, Jonathan, you don't know how we do this, but basically our panelists have an opportunity to share their opinions on a topic, and you can jump in here too. However, we have a two-minute time limit, and when we get to that 2 minutes, we hear Michelle with the bell, the lady with the bell, and then we keep on talking because we're really obnoxious. But anyway, here's our question, debate, whatever you want to call it. General Motors has announced that they will sell an electric version of their microcar, the Chevrolet Spark, in 2013. And right now, however, the current sales leader among electric cars is the Nissan Leaf, and it is actually outpacing the Chevrolet Volt. And that's despite the fact that Chevy had said they thought they'd sell about 10,000 of them this year. They're probably not going to make that. So is it smart for GM to be looking at a pure electric while they also have the Volt? What does GM have to do to kind of get the Volt successful in the marketplace? Do you think it's a good idea as a runabout for city cars? Where does everybody weigh in on an electric version of a microcar, the new Spark? Well, it'd be along the lines of, I guess, the smart car EV. Okay, start the clock.
Well, that was a lot of questions there. I'm not
sure
where
just
to
the whole
address.
Area.
But, you know, obviously
dive right in.
Electric cars are going to be important in the future. I think they absolutely should make one. And they should absolutely make a good one. And I think that's going to be where this car is a make or break if people, want to drive it and enjoy it. A lot of that comes down to making, obviously, a good product.
And they're starting with a pretty decent little car, probably.
A lot of it comes down to, as much as I hate to say, marketing as well. I mean, you got to convince people that A, they can live with an electric car on a daily basis, and that they need it. And we'll see how that goes. But
yeah, I'm not so sure we have any clue yet because we're still looking at early adopters buying these vehicles. Brian,
I would say because they're doing like an urban driver. There's two things you got to worry about. The infrastructure is a big thing because if you are in the city and you live in an apartment complex or a condo or something, there's not going to be places that you can plug in a car like
that. You can't run the cord across the driveway.
Yeah, let's go over the balcony and just shove an extension cord down and do it that way.
That'll last about a minute.
Yeah, and also if you live in the city and you work in the city, you're probably taking public transportation or walking to work, something like that. So that's another thing they have to think about if that's the best place for a car like that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. They keep talking about all these little electric cars for city dwellers. Maybe they don't need them.
Yeah.
Or if they want to go out on the weekends, they want something that has got more than 60 miles worth of range.
Yeah, it's more for the suburban dweller that lives, 15, 20 miles max from work and has a very predictable life that they can just go to work and come home the same every day, not have to worry about a side trip somewhere.
Price is going to be a big factor. I mean, we have the Mitsubishi I coming in, which will be the least expensive EV, and I think this Spark's going to probably be about the same size. So I wonder if GM will basically try to undercut some of the competition and give them a price point.
Sidebar.
Go ahead. You got to ask.
What do you think the Volt's problem is?
For one thing, production has not been what they originally thought it was. They finally ramped up production only in August, I think. Right. So there hasn't been that many out there. But I think primarily people are looking at electric cars a little more warily. And some of the early adopters, this is my opinion, the ones that are most fervent about electric cars wanted a pure electric car.
Correct. Yeah.
So they've gone with the Leaf, not looking at the practicality of it. I think Volt actually is going to probably end up doing very, very well eventually. But, you know, it's a lot of money to pay for new technology. I mean, you were talking, these cars are not cheap. And
good answer.
You know, we'll see. Mm-hmm. Okay, having said that, we now will move on to actually, Jonathan, even though the bell's rung, I'm going to put you on the spot.
Okay, John
all
makes
right.
his own
electric
rules.
Cars. I make my own rules.
Yeah.
You know that.
Well,
what do you think of electric cars?
I actually work with a fellow. My boss just got a Volt.
Uh-huh.
I've been in it. It's an exceptionally quiet, comfortable, futuristic sort of looking on the inside. I was really impressed. He loves it. He drives probably 6 or 7 miles to work each way, but he uses it during the day to go mm-hmm. out. And we had to add a plug at the office so that he could plug it in.
Yeah, but of course he's got a gas engine; he can keep going.
Well, that's true too. Yeah. I thought it was great.
But your first impression was a good one.
Very, very good. And I think there's probably a market for it. I don't think it'll be somebody's only car; mm-hmm. it'll be a second car. Most likely.
But at least with a Volt, it could be your only car.
Yeah.
I guess that's
car,
our right. our point. Oh, it is. Well, that's interesting.
That's right.
Okay, mailbag time. What is the proper – this one comes up all the time. What is the proper position on the steering wheel for your hands? I've heard that 8 and 4 is now the best case for airbag deployment protection. What happened to 10 and 2? This comes, by the way, from Mike. And, okay, who wants to set Mike straight?
I think the only person sitting at this table that's actually had an airbag blow up between their arms should address it first, Ben.
Yeah, I did have an airbag go off of my arms, and I was at the 8 and 4 position because I was kind of braced knowing I was going
oh,
in.
Oh, you knew you were going to go in?
And it did go off. I was wearing short sleeve shirts, and I was burnt on my forearms, blistered up too. But
is that really where you want to put your hands for car control?
Wherever you put your hands, it doesn't matter. They're going to end up at 8 and 4 if you see yourself going into collision.
Okay. In other words, when you see that was you were bracing yourself against the bottom.
You're not
going
to go 10 and 2 to brace yourself.
Well, let me just state for anyone that might be listening that before they start writing in our emails,
too late.
The place that you traditionally always put your hands for best car control, forget about the airbag for a second, is 9 and 3, or 3 and 9 if you depending on which way you want to go around the clock. And really, that's the way a decent steering wheel should be laid out. And I don't want to give anybody the impression that 10 and 2 or 8 and 4 is better because when it comes to car control, 9 and 3 is the best spot. As far as an airbag, I'm not sure you could put your hands anywhere that wouldn't get burned.
That's true. Yeah. And notice we're saying two hands on the wheel. A lot of people are
two hands.
Drive just 8, drive just 9, drive
no.
just 2. The best is to have both hands on the wheel.
If you're doing it at 12 and 6, though, probably not a good idea.
Oh, 12 and 6. Think about that.
Yeah. What about Knight Rider? He was always at...
That's true. Yeah.
The problem is, though, if you have to turn the steering wheel in a hurry, if you actually are going to try to avoid the accidents, 9 and 3 is still your best. I know I sound like a broken record, but all right. So anyway, Mike, we don't think a whole lot of the 8 and 4, and we're not that crazy about 10 and 2, but we all recognize that if you think you're going to hit something, who knows where your hands will end up, but at least you should probably have them on the steering wheel trying to steer away from whatever you're going to hit. Is that fair?
Yeah, I have nothing to add on that one.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I think we've dug ourselves a big enough hole right now that we'll basically wrap up our Motor Week podcast number 62. Unless you, Jonathan, you want to weigh in. Where do you drive, Jonathan? Now tell us the truth.
I probably drive at 10 and 2.
You do drive at 10 and 2?
Probably.
I hope you don't have to steer around something in a
hurry.
Try
not to.
Okay.
Well, BMW, those wheels are made to be in 10 and 2. They always have the thumb rest.
Right. Right, I'll listen to Brian Robinson finding some – dig him out of the hole, Brian.
No, I don't know that 9 and 3 series the best. I mean, it's kind of one of those things you have to know the rules before you can break them. You know, 9-3 9-3 is good, but, you know, if you're driving.
In practicality.
Yeah, put your hands wherever they're comfortable. I mean, if you're not comfortable at 9-3, maybe you're an accident waiting to happen because you feel you should be driving at 9-3 and you're not, you know.
Can we all agree, though, that you should and have two hands on the steering wheel?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, we all agree. No 12 and shifter. That's not a
problem. No 12 and shifter. Okay, I think we eliminated 8-4 only, but 10-2 might be depending on your car, acceptable. Having wrapped that up, 62 is our podcast. I'm John Davis. It's been great being your host today. I want to thank very much everybody around the table, which includes our road test producer and two-wheeling reporter, Brian Robinson, and our associate producer, Ben Davis.
Thanks.
Even though we left him speechless there. Our writer, Brandon Holdhouse.
Thank you.
And our guests, Jonathan Lowe.
Thank you.
Also, I want to thank our audio engineer, Jim Bigwood, who always makes sure we come through loud and clear. Our podcast creator, I can't talk today, that's Bob Mixter. And, of course, our producer, the lady with the bell, Michelle Parker. Thank you very much all for joining us for our Motor Week podcast. Be sure to watch Motor Week on your local public television station. Till next time, I'm John Davis. Thanks very much for listening.
You've been listening to the podcast of Motor Week, television's original automotive magazine. Motor Week is made possible by rockauto.com. For additional information on podcasts, videos, and showtimes, visit our website at motorweek.org. And watch Motor Week, television's longest-running automotive series, each week on your local PBS station.